to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This weekend is the third anniversary of the protests against the World Trade Organization in Seattle that signaled the reemergence of large-scale civil disobedience in the American political landscape and brought Americans into an international movement against corporate globalization that had been off the radar screens of American mainstream media. Even now, most people who don't use alternative news sources have little idea of the anti-globalization movement's goals. For decades, mainstream political rhetoric has equated capitalism, called the free market, with democracy. The anti-globalization movement offers the view that global capitalism is antagonistic to democracy, and that structures such as the WTO are attempting to formally institutionalize capitalism as a de facto world government, in which only corporations and their owners have the rights of citizens. The present financial system could not exist without government intervention. Corporations, as immortal virtual persons that shield their human participants from accountability, are creations of government, as are the laws that dispatch police to enforce their property rights and armies to defend their assets. The Italian fascist dictator Benito Mussolini defined his political program as follows, quote, "Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism, because it is a merger of state and corporate power." In the first hour of the program tonight, Canadian journalist Naomi Klein will speak on Fences and Windows, Dispatches from the Globalization Debate. In the second hour, Wizards of Money follows the path of gifts that will be given this holiday season from China to the U.S. Pacific Coast docks to the retail giant Walmart. Canadian journalist Naomi Klein, author of No Logo, spoke in Toronto on September 26th as part of a speaking tour to launch her latest book, Fences and Windows, Dispatches from the Globalization Debate. Naomi Klein.
This is the fall of the Berlin Wall, 1989. This wall was the symbol for many people of a divided world, the physical manifestation of an absence of freedom. When the wall fell 13 years ago, we were all told that this was ushering in a new age of barriers coming down, of fences coming down around the world, between people, between nations. And in fact, this was so significant that we were told history itself had ended. And this was because democracy was marrying with open markets around the world, which would lead to increased freedom and mobility for all. The disconnected would become connected, the excluded would become included. Now, I think the reason why we've seen so much anger and discontent in the face of this thing that is sometimes called globalization, and some people call neoliberalism and some people just call capitalism, is, of course, that this promise of the global village, of fences coming down, of walls coming down, has been betrayed on so many levels, because 13 years later we are surrounded by various kinds of fences. And those who are on the inside of those barricades are well protected. And those who are on the outside are often completely invisible. So I'm going to be talking about different kinds of fences today, and I'm going to separate them into four neat little categories as a way to try to understand this amorphous thing that goes under this benign euphemism called globalization, which is in fact a globalization of a series of political and economic policies that have enclosed our resources and fenced out millions, if not billions, of people. And I'm also going to be talking about taking fences down, because I think that that's what every movement throughout history has tried to do, to take fences down between peoples, between races, between genders, between classes. And that is our task, I believe, today. But it's a difficult one, because the fences that we are up against are difficult to see often. So it's not necessarily a wall that cuts through the middle of a city like the Berlin Wall. Maybe it's millions of smaller walls with private alarm systems, gated communities that protect the rich from the poor. The first kind of fence that I want to talk about is an invisible fence, which is a process, an economic process, that encloses the shared resources of the planet that we need to live and survive. These are fences that keep water from the thirsty, that keep homes from the homeless, that keep drugs from the dying. Now, these fences that I'm referring to go by many names: privatization, public-private partnerships, patent protections, structural adjustment programs. These are the policies that have been bundled into the very idea of globalization. What we're told is that if we want to join the global economy, then the role of government is simply to create the conditions that are hospitable for international investors, which means giving them opportunities for investment, cracking open whole areas for privatization. I've just returned from South Africa, where I saw the effects of some of these policies very acutely, because South Africa is proceeding with this model of development that is advanced by the International Monetary Fund that has recently been rebranded as NAPAD in Africa. And it involves privatizing basic services like water and electricity. And what this has meant around electricity is that 40,000 people a month lose access to electricity in the poor townships. It also means that 40,000 people who worked for the National Energy Company lost their jobs in order to prepare for privatization. And in explaining the cutoffs, the South African government says that they have to challenge a culture of non-payment, which means that they have to prove to the international buyers that this will be a valuable commodity, that people won't think they have a right to electricity, that they will pay for it. Now, the only problem with this culture of non-payment is that in many of the poor townships, unemployment is at 80%. So it's not exactly a culture of non-payment. It's a culture of being broke. And so there is a sense around the right to electricity that goes up around these policies. And these are even more brutal when they're applied to something as absolutely life-sustaining as water, because we can't survive without it. And water is also being privatized in South Africa. And you see this process of the fencing in of the commons. I was in Alexandra, which is a very poor township that is right downtown in Johannesburg, right next to the richest area where the conference, the World Summit on Sustainable Development, Rio+10, was being held. And there is a river that runs through Alexandra, and there are signs all over it warning people not to drink the water because it's cholera infested, because there was an outbreak of cholera recently where 100,000 people came into contact with the disease and became ill precisely because their water was being cut off, even though it's in the South African Constitution that they have a right to water. And I'm going to come back to that, about how that happens. I was in a community meeting about these cutoffs, about the water and electricity cutoffs, and somebody stood up and they said something very powerful. Now, as many of you know, the South African economy was built on mining, on gold and diamond mining. And this woman stood up and she said, I don't know where these people got this idea, and by these people she was talking about the people who had come to the World Summit on Sustainable Development. And she said, they somehow have gotten this very strange idea that water is like diamonds. It's like gold. But of course, you don't need diamonds. You don't need gold to survive. But you do need water to survive. So there is a sense there, even if you can't see it, that is imposed when user fees are introduced and people can no longer afford access. These invisible boundaries, I think, show us that the current stage in the progression of our globalized markets is not simply about trade, even though that's what we call it, free trade, in the sense of trading goods and services across borders. It's about feeding the need that is at the very center of a capitalist economy, which is the need for growth and expansion, with new opportunities for growth and expansion, particularly during a recession, particularly when there's an oversupply of so many products and services. By redefining entire sectors entire areas of our ecology as products, as services, that were never seen as products or commodities before. Now, this is a very profound process of sensing in the commons, of reaching into every aspect of our lives, from health to education, ideas, genes, seeds, which are now patented and fenced off, as well as traditional remedies, plants, of course, water, and even human stem cells, all being privatized and enclosed, fenced in. And this is a process that transforms every activity and natural resource into a measured and owned commodity. So this process is very much less about trade than about enclosure. And there's a very simple reason for that, and probably there's a good hint in the fact that the U.S.'s single largest export is not manufactured goods. It's not arms. It is copyright. That is the U.S.'s single largest export. So that means patents on everything from Britney Spears CDs to AIDS drugs. And in this context, the role of international trade law, this process that we call globalization, is actually not about taking barriers down and freeing the markets. What it's actually about is systematically putting new barriers up around knowledge, around technology, around newly privatized resources, enclosing the commons through patents and trademarks. These are the virtual fences that go up around intellectual property, around natural resources. And they have very real effects, even if they are virtual. These are the fences that tell a farmer in India that they can't replant their seeds. They have to rebuy them every year from Monsanto. And these are the fences that tell artists that they can't cut and paste images from popular culture, of course, because they've all been trademarked. And these are the fences that tell countries where millions of people are dying from AIDS that they can't copy a drug and distribute it to save lives, even though in Brazil, the breaking of these patents and the disseminating of generic antiretrovirals for free to anyone who needs them has cut the number of AIDS-related deaths in half. This brings me to the second kind of fence that I want to talk about, which is very closely related. And this is the fence that surrounds our democracy, that surrounds democracy itself. Now, Brazil has been hauled in front of the World Trade Organization for their visionary AIDS policies because they have broken those drug patents. And we've experienced some of this fencing in of our democracy on smaller scales with Chapter 11 challenges under NAFTA. In poorer countries, this process of fencing in democracy is, of course, very old. And it's often associated with foreign debt. And it's often enforced by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And the deal goes like this, and I'm sure you're all familiar with it, which is you can have a loan as long as you follow the following prescriptions from the International Monetary Fund, that you will open up more markets to privatization, you will privatize your water and electricity and phone system, you will create these opportunities and prove that you are worthy of competing in the global economy. You will continue, of course, to pay off the debt, and you will eliminate various subsidies to national industries, and so on. Now, this process helps explain why what I'm describing is going on in South Africa is going on, because often deals are made in the transition from a repressive regime, from a dictatorship or a racist regime like apartheid to a so-called democracy that ensures that democracy will remain shallow, that it will remain in some ways enslaved. Now, as you all know, South Africa is home to the most powerful, perhaps the most powerful liberation struggle of our time. And the African National Congress's promise laid out in the Freedom Charter was not just about granting South Africans the vote. It was a vision of a just society that would rebuild the violence of apartheid by redistributing land, by bringing in massive public works projects that would create jobs, that would build dignified homes, that would bring water and electricity to the townships. Now, much of this was started and then interrupted. Part of this had to do with the deal that was made in the 1993-1994 period, and it was a kind of a quid pro quo, which said, you can have the vote, but you have to inherit the debt of your oppressors, or you will be penalized. You will be penalized by international markets, and you have to continue the economic project that was started under apartheid, continue with the privatizations and so on. It was incredibly painful to see, to be going to community meetings as we were in Soweto and Alexandra, and be meeting people. 70-year-old men would stand up at these meetings, and 80-year-old women, and say, and be talking about having their electricity cut off or being evicted from their home that they've been living in for 20 years, and say, you know, I've been fighting for freedom my whole life. And you could often see the scars of that fight, people with limbs that have been amputated, with tremendous physical scars. And they had been fighting, everyone who I met, for the ANC. They had been part of that liberation struggle. And there was this one man who stood up and he said, I've been fighting my whole life and I'm so tired. And you could look at him and you could see, and he actually was missing a leg, and you could see how incredibly tired he was. And he said, but I just had my electricity cut off and I have to keep fighting. As Elisa mentioned, Avi and I are making a film about Argentina. And the original intention was to focus on the current economic crisis that we hear about in the news. But when we got there, we found that everybody was talking about history. Everybody was talking about the dictatorship that ended in 1983, because they traced the transition from dictatorship to democracy as the root of the current economic crisis and their current lack of freedom and possibilities. Some of you know, some of you don't know Argentina's history, and I can't do it justice here right now except to say that it is an incredibly brutal and bloody history, and that between 1976 and 1983 actually began before the dictatorship. There was something called the Dirty War, when 30,000 people were disappeared, and they use the phrase disappeared because they weren't murdered like in Chile at point blank range. They were snatched from their homes, and then when their mothers and grandmothers would go to the police station to try to find them, there was no record of them. They disappeared without a trace. The transition from dictatorship to democracy that happened in 1983 was once again a negotiated transition, and the military gave up power. There was, of course, popular pressure, but they also agreed to give up power on certain conditions. Now, what were those conditions? And we start to see similar patterns. The deal was, you can have the vote, but we want economic continuity. Now, what does economic continuity mean? One, you inherit your dictator's debt. The debt that has crippled Argentina dates back to the military dictatorship. When the military dictatorship began, there was a very small debt. It skyrocketed. Much of it ended up in Swiss bank accounts, but it was passed on to the people who lived under the regime. The other economic continuity was also very specific. To keep certain key people, like the finance minister, in the same job. So they had the same finance minister under dictatorship as they did under democracy. The same head of the central bank. So you might say, okay, that's ancient history. We don't do that to our democracies now. We don't chain them in this way. But of course, that's not true. Look at what's happening in Brazil right now. Brazil is about to elect a new president, Lula da Silva, who is the leader of the Workers' Party in Brazil, the PT, a self-described socialist, a man who has spent his entire life promising that if he ever became president, he would not pay the external debt. He's also said very recently at the World Social Forum in January that if he became president, there would be no free trade area of the Americas, and there couldn't be a free trade area of the Americas without the largest economy in Latin America, which is Brazil. Well, a lot has changed during the campaign. A few tactics were tried when it was clear that Lula was really gaining in the polls. There were a lot of scare tactics, a lot of attempts to prop up his opponents, who were just so corrupt that no matter how much help they got, they just couldn't be saved. When it was clear that nothing was actually going to keep Lula from being elected, the IMF offered Brazil a bailout $30 billion bailout. Now, what does that mean? And what does it have to do with democracy? Well, what it has to do with democracy is that it's post-dated. 80% of the so-called bailout won't come until after the election. It is specified in the loan that it can be revoked if the new government in Brazil tries to change economic course and no longer follows IMF policies and prescriptions. These are a small sampling of the fences I believe we're up against today, our modern fences, which are fencing in our shared resources, our land, water, electricity, education, healthcare, and also at the same time, and I think more fundamentally, fencing in our ability to imagine that we can even do anything about it, fencing in our imaginations. Now, of course, there are those who will say that there is nothing wrong with a good fence. You need it to protect your private property. But I think it's important to look at whose fences are actually being protected right now. Now, the U.S. employees of Enron didn't find that their private property was being protected particularly well, because when their company was going bankrupt and they wanted to cash in their privatized retirement savings, they found that they had been locked out, even as their bosses were frantically cashing in their own stocks. And this was happening actually at exactly the same time that Argentine citizens who deposited their money in Scotiabank, Citibank, HSBC, and thought it would be safe after all they had worked for it their whole lives, found last December that they no longer had access to those accounts, that the money in many cases had simply disappeared and they had to watch it devalue half, a third, a quarter. And the banks themselves, meanwhile, were free to pull their money out. And even if it was against the law, they did it anyway. And there was a law, actually, in Argentina that declared that this was economic subversion when the banks were pulling their money out. And they started going after the bankers. They started prosecuting them. And what the IMF did is they made that, eliminating that law that was prosecuting those bankers, a condition of getting a new loan. So they said to Argentina, if you want a new loan from us, and as you all know, I mean, they're in negotiations, then you have to do a few things. One of them was you have to cut spending by 60% in the provinces. There were other conditions, but one of the conditions was you must eliminate the economic subversion law and stop prosecuting those bankers. And they did it all, and they still didn't get the loan. What's interesting to me is that the name the government gave the policy that locked Argentines out of their bank accounts was El Corralito, which means the little fence. And it's still up. The third kind of fence is the fence of social exclusion. The reverse fence that decrees that certain people are no longer necessary for the production of wealth, that fences people out of the global economy. So what do I mean by that? What does social exclusion mean? We hear that word a lot. And I like to quote our Minister of Trade on this, Pierre Pettigrew. He said in the run-up to the FTA meeting in Quebec City, he was musing on why there were all these protests. And he said, in the old economy, you had people who were oppressed. Now you have people who are excluded, i.e. no longer needed in the production of wealth. So some of the economically excluded might be people who live in a valley in India that is about to be flooded by a huge mega dam, like the people who live in the Narmada Valley, and they're about to have their ancestral land submerged without their consultation. Or maybe it's a small farmer in Canada who has been told that their way of life is backwards, that they are unable to compete with factory farms, and they should just move to the city and get with the program. Or maybe they work for a public company that is getting ready to be privatized, which I've already mentioned. In Argentina, this crisis that came to a peak last December started with the privatization process in the mid-90s, where you had public sector companies going from employing 5,500 people to employing 5,000 people overnight. So you had whole communities just being wiped off the map. And there was a phrase that started to be used, which was the economically disappeared. And this was in a country where where people had been physically disappeared under the dictatorship. So they started talking about people who were being economically erased, no longer existing. And part of the reason was that there was a very strong rural and urban divide, just as there is here in Canada. So they were invisible to the people in Buenos Aires who were living the boom and living off the paper economy and living off the service economy. As the unemployment rate was soaring and reaching 30%, the people in the cities couldn't quite believe that anything could really be going wrong when they seemed to be going so well. Some of this is quite familiar, I think, from our own economic boom. Now, this process of disappearing people is very dangerous because one of the effects is that it can breed a sort of nihilistic violence that is a hallmark, I think, both of the urban gangster and even the terrorist. Because a culture that is willing to live side by side with the walking disappeared is a culture that also lives with blinding rage at invisibility, twisted revenge of those who settle in the last moments of their lives for being seen, for being visible. But the truth is that these, of course, are the radical and sensational exceptions. And the truth is that remarkably few of the world's fenced out people turn to violence. What most people simply do is they just move from countryside to city, looking for work, from country to country. Now, the fourth kind of fence I want to talk about is the fence that people encounter when they start to move. Now, these fences are not virtual. These are very real, made of chain link and razor wire, reinforced with concrete, guarded with machine guns. And I just want to show some images of some of those fences. The first image is of a fenced-in factory. This is the Chentex garment factory in Managua, Nicaragua. It's one of thousands of export processing zones around the world, which are gated industrial parks. And the majority of the workers, the vast majority of the workers, are young women from the countryside, whose families have become landless, who are displaced mostly by industrial agriculture, and come to get jobs in the maquiladoras. And they're gated and guarded for a couple of reasons. One is to keep the goods from getting out because they're so heavily subsidized and they're only available for export. They can't be sold domestically, so they have to keep them from escaping the factory. And the other reason why there are fences and guards is to keep the union organizers from getting in. The next image is of the Wamra Detention Center in Australia. It's in the South Australian desert, what's sometimes called the outback. It's located 500 kilometers from the nearest city. And I visited it last year. It's a former military base. And the South Australia desert is a place where, throughout history, different colonizing forces have managed to convince themselves that no one is there, that it's a no man's land. And when the British first came to Australia, they declared it terra nullius, and they put Aboriginal people on the same status as flora and fauna. They said, there's no one here. And then when they wanted to test nuclear weapons in the South Australian desert, they also said, well, there's no one here. But of course there were people there, and there still are people there. But this same logic, which I think really is a genocidal logic, has led to the creation of these refugee holding pens, these detention centers in the desert. This one is, it's owned by Wak and Hut. And if you can imagine that the refugees who come on boats, mostly Afghan and Iraqi refugees, are taken from the boats to the middle of the desert, and are disappeared. And they are so desperate to get the world's attention, because there they are, 500 kilometers from the nearest city. The only people who live near them are NATO officers, not much help. And they've taken ever more extreme measures to try to get the world's attention. And you read about this every once in a while in the newspaper. And the most extreme measures have been people jumping off of buildings inside the Wamra Detention Center, drinking shampoo, or even sewing their mouths shut to try to get the world to see what's going on there. And the next series of slides, there's four of them, are from one of the biggest fences of them all, which is the U.S.-Mexican border. that since NAFTA, this border has become increasingly militarized, and we're seeing our country being bundled inside Fortress USA as we speak. Now, it's a very, very dangerous place, and here there are images of people trying to sneak across the border, and the crosses in the last image represent people who have been killed trying to cross the border. Now, all of our borders are becoming increasingly militarized, but I can't really talk about fences and walls without talking about the security wall that's going up in the West Bank, separating Israeli villages from Palestinian cities, and that's an image of one of the bulldozers creating the fence there. The last thing I want to say about fences is an obvious point, which is that all these fences are connected, that the real ones, made of steel and razor wire and concrete, are needed to enforce the virtual ones, the ones that put our resources and wealth that we need to survive out of the hands of so many people, whether it's water or life-saving drugs. It simply isn't possible to lock away this much of our collective wealth and so many people's right to self-determination without an accompanying strategy of containment, of popular unrest, and of mobility. And we know this because security firms do their biggest business in the cities where the gap between rich and poor is greatest. Johannesburg, Sao Paulo, New Delhi, selling iron gates and armored cars and elaborate alarm system, renting out armies of private security guards. Many of us are often protected from seeing the types of fences, and that's why I wanted to show those slides, because we don't see the detention centers, and we don't even see our militarized borders, because we have two-tiered border systems. And I think that this is why, increasingly, the task of social justice activism is to try to reappear people, to stage reappearing acts. And I'll tell you what I mean. I'll give you a few examples of some recent reappearances that are very consciously reappearances. Many people date the current wave of globalization protests to Seattle, and they're wrong. Many people also date them back to January 1st, 1994, which is the day that the Zapatistas began their uprising. And that was also the day that NAFTA became law, which is the reason why they chose that day. When the Zapatistas began their uprising, they took up arms and they put on masks. And they said something very interesting. They said that they were waging a war against invisibility, and it was a war against oblivion. I don't know if we've ever heard anyone say that they're waging a war against oblivion. And there's an interesting irony there, because, of course, when you put on a mask, you usually are trying to hide your face and hide your identity. But what the Zapatistas said is that they weren't hiding at all. What they were actually doing was the opposite. They were reappearing. They were coming out of the shadows. And they were forcing the world to stop ignoring their plight, to see their long-neglected faces. And they have this phrase, which is that the Zapatista is the face that hides itself to be seen. In Australia, thousands of young people in the past year have been trying to dramatize those disappearances that are going on in the desert, to expose them, to out them. And they've been doing this by organizing caravans from Melbourne and Sydney and Adelaide to the Wamarra Detention Center. And I think this is part of the next wave of direct action that is no longer just about symbolic actions outside of meetings, outside of summits, but about direct action that are immediately connected to making people's lives better right now. They're not abstract discussions about globalization. They are rooted and connected. And we'll see some pictures of some of those actions later on. I think here in Toronto, we have some great reappearances. I think OCAP is really good at challenging invisibility. My favorite OCAP action, and I know that my favorite reappearance act was when OCAP evicted our Minister of Housing. I know that wasn't so popular, but I mean, how do you dramatize the invisible evictions? I thought it was a pretty creative way, and I know that there was a lot of sympathy for his filing cabinets, but everything's relative, you know. In Argentina, I talked about the layoffs that started in the mid-90s around the privatizations and the creation of classes of economically disappeared people and erased people. But Argentina has a very long history of militant labor organizing. And a lot of the people who got laid off, and they use the phrase disappeared because they talked about how people were being dispersed into their homes and were no longer a constituency. When you work in a factory, you can organize. You can have a strike. You can affect the economy. You are a visible constituency. And when you're laid off, suddenly you are diffuse. You are in your homes, and people started drinking, and they started fighting. So some of the union organizers who had lost their jobs thought that it was time to organize a new kind of labor movement, a labor movement that would unionize the unemployed. And they called themselves the Picoteros. They developed a technique which was a reverse picket line because they didn't have factories to close down anymore because they didn't have jobs. They realized that they still could interrupt the flow of trade by blocking the roads and the railways that kept the goods from flowing. So they started organizing these piquetes, and they weren't just a day-long thing or even a week-long thing. They would often last for as long as a month. And what would happen is that entire communities would move into the roadways, into huge highways, and they would build kind of shanty towns in the highways. And many people from the Picotero movement also had experience in the land occupation movement, so they knew how to build a shanty town. And that's what they did in the roads. And the slogan that was adopted was that the new factory is the neighborhood. The new factory is the barrio. And the idea is that instead of just organizing one sector of the population, which is what we normally do, you know, organize workers or organize students, and then that group gets uprooted from where they live, and it also erases the fact that we're always more than one thing. We're not just workers, we're also parents, we're also members of our communities. And this seemed to work. So the piquetes are sort of, they feel a bit like a street festival as well as a picket line. Now, when this started to happen in the mid-90s, and everything was booming in downtown Buenos Aires, you can imagine that people complained about traffic. And they told the picoteros to get a job and that they had to move with the times. But of course, the crisis started reaching into the cities and reaching into the middle class, and professionals started losing their jobs and then access to their bank accounts. So the middle class and even the upper middle class, no longer middle class, in Argentina has been learning from these tactics, these reappearance tactics, and have organized their own factories in their neighborhoods. They call them neighborhood assemblies. And hundreds of them have sprung up in the past year in Argentina. And when you drive around Buenos Aires at night, you see groups of people, 200, 300, in plazas, on street corners, in parks. At first I didn't know what they were doing, and then I noticed that they were voting. They were voting on what they wanted to do about the economic crisis. They were voting on what solutions to take. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about what the neighborhood assemblies in Argentina are doing. As these reappearances have taken place, more fences have materialized, and we shouldn't be surprised by that, that more fences have intruded into full view. And fittingly, many of these fences have appeared during the summits when this brutal economic model is advanced. This is happening right now in Washington. The World Bank and the IMF are meeting this weekend, and I just got a press release right before I came here that said that all protest permits have been denied for Washington for the weekend. So anybody who has a protest is behaving illegally this weekend. And, of course, we all had our own experience with a caged city during the Summit of the Americas last April when our government decided to cage downtown Quebec City. And I just saw a similar phenomenon in South Africa where in order to have this summit, which was about eliminating poverty, allegedly, the South African government had to go to such extents to protect themselves from poor people that they built what they called a mega search park, and they had spy planes patrolling the skies. There was extreme repression of protests. Now, in many cases, these fences have been incorporated into activist strategies and have become almost part of the message. And we saw this in Quebec City, that the fence became a symbol of the policies themselves, of a symbol of exclusion. And all kinds of tactics were used to dramatize that, from flicking tear gas canisters back with hockey sticks to the famous wooden catapult that hurled teddy bears over the fence. These aren't the only fences that are coming down. In Brazil, the MST, which is a movement of landless people, which has more than 1 million members, cuts down fences around unused farmland, because the Brazilian government has been promising for years to introduce land reform in a country where so much land is concentrated in the hands of a few. This is a hallmark of the MST, the cutting down of the fence and the occupation of the land. This action is called Cutting the Wire, and there's a book about this process by Sue Bradford and Jan Rocha called Cutting the Wire, and they say, cutting the wire is how the MST described the act of occupying the land, the cornerstone of their movement. It is the baptism of fire for the militant, an essential part of their identity, and it plays a key role in the mystica, the moment of collective ritual that kicks off all MST events. Now, there are lots of other examples of cutting down fences and reclaiming spaces, from students kicking ads out of their classrooms, to swapping music and art online, to setting up independent media centers with free software, or Bolivian workers reversing the privatization of their water supply in Cochabamba. There's an amazing group in South Africa called the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee. What they do is they take these two forces that I described earlier, which is the fact that 40,000 people are losing access to electricity and that 40,000 people lost their jobs working for that company. And they take those unemployed electricians and match them with those homes and reconnect their electricity. Yeah. Now, of course, we've seen this spirit of impatience, of direct action, of concrete action here in Canada in many ways. In First Nations communities, from Sun Peaks to Burnt Church, where there's growing support for seizing back control of the forest and fisheries and not waiting for Ottawa to grant permission that the courts have already granted. And of course, we see it in anti-poverty direct action, from the now shamefully evicted Tent City here in Toronto, to OCAP's Pope Squat, to the takeover of the Woodward building in Vancouver, which was also brutally shut down last week. But of course, the real fight is not just a reaction to fences, both virtual and substantial. It's also a fight for sustained freedom, a fight to prevent the fences of the future. And in order to do that, we have to ask ourselves some pretty profound questions about how we made the mistakes in the past that made it so easy to take over our democracies, to fence in our democracies and our resources. And a lot of the solutions that are emerging organically around the world have to do with democracy itself and a critique of the way we've come to see democracy simply as delegating power upwards and a kind of consumer action of voting every 4 or 5 years and letting an outsourcing government to experts. And so in trying to develop these alternative movements and spaces, many of the social movements that I've been talking about have also been experimenting with quite radical forms of democracy within their own ranks and trying to live another kind of democracy that can be expanded. And the Picoteros, for instance, in Argentina, have been experimenting with all kinds of ways to try to avoid the bureaucratization of the labor movement and the centralization of power within the labor movement. And one of the Picotero groups that we spent some time with had a rule that the leadership had to resign every 4 months. and then they had to go through a period of criticism and auto-criticism. And then maybe they were reelected. But all decisions were taken in open assemblies, which was much, I think, more significant than that. So the idea is that you're actually not delegating power, you're giving clear direction, and you can keep your leaders on a pretty short leash. The assembleas, who are voting on every street corner, also have a system of rotating leadership. The same person can't chair a meeting 2 weeks in a row. And everybody is on the same par. So you know, if you're a politician, you know, elected national deputy and you want to go to a neighborhood assembly, you just have to put your name on the speaker's list like everybody else. And if you're head of the political science department at the University of Buenos Aires, you know, you're not there to give a speech. You just put your name on the list and have your say as a neighbor. One of the differences in language in the neighborhood assembly movement is to challenge Latin American leftists usually have called themselves compañero, which is the equivalent of comrade. And they decided that they want people not to talk to each other as politicians, but to talk to each other as people, as neighbors. So they address each other as vecino, which just means neighbor. And what started to happen is that this movement came out of protest. It came out of the banging of the pots and pans that we saw in the news in December. And it has been developing a kind of a shadow state in the months that have passed since. So those pots and pans that people were banging are now used in community kitchens to feed the hungry. Now, I think that these structures are different from what we've seen before, and it's particularly stark in Argentina because there's such a powerful authoritarian history there. I think we all have our own versions of it, but it's more dramatic because this is where Che Guevara is from. This is where Evita is from. And that tendency to believe in saviors, to believe in heroes, which often degenerates into believing in strongmen, and is exactly what's being challenged. Because I think today there is a frustration with that model, and that what we really are looking for are less heroes and saviors than tools. What we need are tools, mechanisms to enforce democracy, to keep power closer to home or dispersed. And the tools that they're starting to develop in Argentina, what they're talking about are models like constituent assemblies, very, very short mandates for politicians, participatory budgets like they've been experimenting with in Brazil, in 200 cities in Brazil, and cities and towns. Argentina has elections coming up in March, and there's a movement there to not run any candidates, but to only run ideas. So the idea is that instead of putting a candidate on a ballot, you write in the idea that you're in favor of, because precisely what is being challenged is the idea that political change can just come by believing in a truer, better left who says the right things. And I think when Lula is elected in Brazil and people see how restricted he is, there will be even more momentum for this type of change. And it strikes me that in the face of all of these fences, in the face of all of these attempts at containment, this is a pretty good strategy. The goal is to be uncontainable, to be everywhere. Because you actually can't contain a movement that is everywhere. So you have a two-part strategy that I think is the most promising strategy as we think about alternatives, which is to create sites of radical political participation in decision-making that are legitimized precisely by our participation and our engagement, that also can become sites of radical non-participation. Because once communities are truly organized, they're better able to simply refuse to implement the brutal economic policies that are being handed down by the provinces or the federal government. And we're starting to see this at the school board level here in Ontario. So I think we can hope to see more of that, and this is where we should be building radicalized and democratized school boards that refuse to cut our school system further, and electing city councillors that can legalize the squatting of abandoned buildings rather than letting more people die on our streets. So our cities can become sites of resistance, and it's already happening. And what's exciting to me about this political model is that it relies on a theory of power that doesn't replicate the same process of centralization and delegation, but is instead fundamentally anti-fundamentalist, which is awfully refreshing these days as we are surrounded by fundamentalists of all kinds, religious, economic, and political. So it doesn't seek to impose a system from on high, but creates the mechanisms for many, many diverse and subtle systems to emerge from below. So I do believe that despite all of these fences, that there is reason to be optimistic. And the reason for that is that despite all these attempts at privatization and enclosure, it turns out that there are still things that don't want to be owned, that have resistance to enclosure, music, water, seeds, ideas, and particularly people. They keep bursting out of the confines that we put around them. They have a tendency to escape, to cross-pollinate, to flow through fences and fly open windows. And I just want to end by reading you a quote that appeared in Now magazine today. It's not about me, I promise. It's about the attack on Tent City. And I'm sure you all know that the city has shut down Tent City because apparently Home Depot was worried about liability. So what did they do? Well, they put up a fence, right? So Mike Smith wrote this article, an eyewitness account of what happened there in the last few days. And I just want to read the last paragraph. He says, as the company began to put up fencing around the site, a few residents and supporters started to remove the fence posts just as quickly. Slowly, more gathered to help until a deconstruction process was moving along the path, physically symbolizing the spirit of resistance, a spirit that no one will ever be able to evict. Thank you.
That was Canadian author and journalist Naomi Klein speaking in Toronto 2 months ago on Fences and Windows, Dispatches from the Globalization Debate. Thanks to CKLN and Ontario Indie Media for that tape. In the early hours of November 15th, police stormed houses in a number of cities in southern Italy and arrested 20 representatives of anti-globalization protest movements. A total of 41 people are the subject of investigations throughout Italy. A mass demonstration of over 500,000 people against U.S. war in Iraq took place on November 12th in the Italian city of Florence. The demonstration, which was peaceful, came at the end of the first meeting of the European Social Forum, a week of discussions and debates on the social consequences of globalization. Many of those arrested on November 15th participated in and helped organize the activities of the forum and the mass demonstration. According to newspaper reports, the state prosecutor's office in Cosenza had conducted a 1.5-year investigation leading to the arrests. This probe produced a 360-page file on the activities of the anti-globalization protesters and included detailed surveys of 60,000 emails, the systematic surveillance of internet sites, the shadowing of suspects, film recordings, and wiretaps. Most of the charges leveled against the activists are based on Italian laws that were introduced and extensively used by the fascist regime of Benito Mussolini to silence any opposition. Article 270 enables prosecution merely on the basis that, according to the prosecutor, the accused were planning or conspiring to conduct activities detrimental to the Italian government. Article 270 explicitly refers to the danger of groups aiming to overthrow the economic order of Italy. Mass demonstrations in protest of the arrests have occurred in several Italian cities, and more are scheduled. A lawyer representing Francesco Caruso, one of the accused, commented in a newspaper interview, "The government is seeking to criminalize the movement precisely at a time when its policies and forms of action are finding more and more support among ordinary people and in the trade unions." Caruso recently wrote an open letter to the anti-globalization movement from jail. Here are some translated excerpts of his letter. Caruso wrote, "A million men and women in Florence have declared, repeated and shouted out loud, that another world is possible and necessary, a world without war or humanitarian bombardments, a world in which wars will be avoided simply by not fighting them, a world in which a house, a job, an income, water and land will be the right of everyone, rather than privileges only for some. A million is a lot of people. Behind the bars of this prison cell, democracy, justice, and dignity are empty words, concepts, and values which are impossible to perceive. Paradoxically, I have to thank the Cosenza magistrates for having sent me to hellish prisons of Trani and Viterbo, which are so reminiscent of Dante's Inferno. With prisoners kept like battery hens, where even the most basic right becomes a favor to be begged for, Here, democracy, justice, and dignity can all be translated as immediate amnesty for all. But is it really possible to speak of democracy, justice, and dignity in a country where the political opposition is persecuted? Isn't this the dividing line between democracy and authoritarianism, the sign of the inversion of democracy? "We are all subversives" is the cry not only for rebels and activists, but also for every member of civil society, every sincere Democrat who believes and hopes that we live in a mature democracy. At stake is not merely our release from prison, which is of secondary importance, but the viability of the democratic opposition in Italy. If the Cosenza theorem is accepted, then every activist, everyone who has worked in recent years for the idea that an other world is possible, everyone who was on the demonstrations in Naples, Genoa, and Florence is liable to be persecuted as a dangerous and violent subversive. But it gets worse. Especially in the political, economic, and cultural establishment, in the upper echelons of the power structure, there are people who view the social movements as a dangerous virus to be fought, an evil to be defeated, the disorder to be repressed, to reestablish order and discipline so as to preserve their own power. The rise of the anti-globalization movement has caused certain sectors of the power elite, the judiciary, and the forces of order to fear the activism of the movements and their potential for social transformation and questioning of the present order of things. Impartiality has been abandoned in favor of an obsessive degree of political persecution, which culminated in the violence of Genoa and the murder of Carlo Giuliani. The absurd Cosenza theorem once again turns the spotlight onto the special operations group of the Carabinieri, the only body which has not been investigated for its responsibilities in Genoa, and on to some crafty magistrates. The last time that the charge of political conspiracy was used was during the fascist dictatorship, and before then at the time of the romantic Carabinari in the 19th century. Of course, if we are compared with our grandparents who fought the fascists, or our great-grandparents who were Carabinari, then we are honored. The dangerous subversives, the true criminals, are in fact on the other side of the barricade. They are those who try to push the movement onto the terrain of physical or military conflict, because they well know that this is the only terrain on which they can defeat us. But the movement has shown, at Genoa and after, that it has the political maturity to avoid being trapped in this way. This ridiculous inquiry will not shake us. And that is not all. As with the Genoa experience, this political attack will not push us back or break our movement. It will reinforce our knowledge that we must fight our battles with redoubled energy. It shows us that at stake is not just the possibility of conquering new rights and social guarantees, but also the defense of democracy, the canceling out of the reactionary strategies that have been used in recent decades to attack previous cycles of social mobilization. Therefore, it is important for the movement to free itself from the grip of those who would strangle it, and from the cycle of repression and resistance to repression, which clips the wings of the process of social transformation. Therefore, quite apart from the essential battle to denounce the political and persecutory nature of this operation, it is important to continue promoting the movement and its policies. At the same time, we have to speak up for the practice of civil disobedience as a perfectly legitimate form of mobilization against the many, too many injustices which oppress our global world. No inquiry and no magistrate can stop us from doing this. We shall be there with our hearts, but so many others will be there in person, alongside the people of Melito who are fighting to get their houses back, the unemployed who are demanding a job or at any rate an income, the fiat workers who are fighting to defend their jobs, the immigrants who will demonstrate in Turin on the 30th of November against the concentration camps. The other side do not realize that their efforts are in vain and they will lose this battle too. We are an army dressed in rags, but we are also, and above all, dreamers. This is why we cannot be beaten. And that was an excerpt from jailed Italian anti-globalization activist Francesco Caruso.